The fog is getting thicker.
And Leon's getting larger.
And it's just surrealistic and it's weird. And that's my sense of humor. And I used to do that to my dad. So after the movie came out, I would go, and Leon's getting long. My dad would hate me when I would do that. We're not, this is not the thing yet. We haven't started yet, have we?
Well, unless you don't want it to be.
Oh. That's the old Marc Maron trick, which is you just start chatting and then like, when do we start? Oh, we started this. Oh, this is the thing.
Hey, welcome to Radio Labyrinth. We have another guest this week. I hope you all are liking the guests as much as we are. This week's guest is Dan Pasternak. He's one of the great champions of comedy. Beyond his work creating and preserving some of the funniest moments in television, Dan is also the proud owner of one of the world's largest collections of autographed comedy albums. So we'll talk to him about that. I love comedy albums. I have a ton of them. He's even taking his passion on the road, touring with David Zucker and Robert Hayes, to celebrate the enduring brilliance of the classic film Airplane. Now, earlier today, I was looking through, well, it's been the past week, looking through all of his credits, all the things he's done, and it's going to be, it would be impossible. You'd have to do, I don't know, a six-part series to even scratch the surface when it comes to Dan. Well, it's nice to see you. Thank you for
Lovely
coming
to
up.
Lovely to see you as well, Tim. No, I have no crew, so I'm already outnumbered. I'm daunted by this entire undertaking.
Very easy and fun. We've all been kind of doing a deep dive, and you have so much in your background. So we figured we would just parse it down a little bit and focus on a couple things. But so many cool things from your career, going back to even when you were a youngster doing songs and sending them off to get played by Dr. Demento and actually ending up in the Funny Five, if I'm not incorrect.
The top 10.
Okay, the top 10.
Because the Funny Five was part of the nationally syndicated Dr. Demento show. Oh. Growing up in Los Angeles, I had the great good fortune of having the live four-hour Dr. Demento show on KMET, 94.7 Little Bit of Heaven.
What? I didn't know that he did that. That I wish I could have heard all that.
Some of us are just, blessed by the gift of geography at birth.
Yeah, we didn't. I don't think we had him in Atlanta at all.
No, they didn't.
Really?
No, I've looked. I've asked old school radio disc jockeys from the 70s and 80s if the doctor was on here. And
how is that possible?
Yeah, that's a good question. I can't believe that he wasn't. Because he was everywhere. I mean, if he was in Elmira, New York, then he should have certainly been on in in Atlanta, you know? And that's what I got on the show. I forget the name of the song. It's Sister Jenny's Time to Build a Bomb. I called up and did a crazy thing, and I found out that I was going to be on the show. And
oh, yes. You sent me that link. That very, very funny.
And yeah, I was just like, oh, God, that was the best thing that had happened to me up until the age of 16.
Well, Barry Hansen, Dr. Demento, is still alive, still with us today.
I know, and he's retiring, unfortunately.
He is. Well, 55 years, that's a pretty good run.
Yeah, that is. That is right. In that episode of, was it The Nerdist or was it something prior to The Nerdist? But it was you and Chris and Dr. Demento was on, and at the end of it, they closed with your song, which is great. So I made a copy of that. If you don't mind, I want to play a little bit of it here. No.
Kit lost his mitt, he had a bit, and he said, oh shoot. Chuck was driving a truck when he hit a duck, and he said, oh heck. Joe?
Well, the way Chris got that recording is, so we did the podcast, which I recall as being 2012, I think. And Chris had not known that I made a record when I was 11 years old. And so that was a revelation. I've known Hardwick for a long time, well before that. And so he was like, oh, my God, I have to get a copy of that. And, you know, I did my usual shtick, which was like, let me see if I can find it. Oh, boy, I don't know if I have a copy of that. Oh, I'm traveling. I don't think I can get it to you in time for the podcast. Oops. And then he reaches out to Barry Hanson, Dr. Demento, who has, you know, a half a million records. I figure he's not going to be able to put his hands on his copy of it. Sure enough, he did. He digitized it. He sent it to Chris. Chris slapped it on the podcast.
That must have been a great surprise.
Well, who got the last laugh? Not this guy.
I think it showed a lot of ingenuity and comedy genius at the age you were. What were you, 11 years old when you made that?
I was 11 years old. I was in the, it was the summer between the sixth and the seventh grade. So I was on my way to junior high. And oh, what a fanfare with which I was met when I arrived at junior high as a freshly minted Dr. Demento recording artist. I was so popular with the girls. And
yeah, the girls really dug Dr. Demento in our school too. Jeff and I went to high school together up in Pennsylvania.
Well, so, it's an adorable song. And yeah. It reminds me of the stuff me and my sisters used to make on like a tape recorder growing up, you know? I mean, but better quality, obviously.
Oh, well, thank you. I felt very much like a misfit back in those days. I don't even think the term comedy nerd was in common parlance. I was just that weird guy over there.
Yeah, I can relate to that, except yeah. I was all gross guy over there because I could make people laugh by doing gross things, and that sort of helped me not get beat up a lot.
Give me an example of a gross thing, Tim.
I would put peas in my nose at the lunch table and then shoot them out. I invented this thing called yo-yo spit, which was very disgusting, but you can kind of imagine what it is after drinking milk.
Oh, dear God.
A lot of things to make Jeff laugh, although Jeff would make me laugh and I would get in trouble for it. But we have you here ostensibly to talk about Airplane. Now, how old were you when Airplane was released?
You know what? It's the same year as my record. Oh, it was, wow. That's a big year for comedy.
Yeah.
The debut record of Dan Pasternak and Airplane. Yeah, 1980.
1980. Did your parents take you to see the movie or let you go see it, or did you have to wait?
I saw it in the theater. I saw it at the it was at the Bruin Theater in Westwood, California, and I believe I saw it there twice. Wow. Oh, my God, I loved it. I can't remember if I saw it with my parents or if I saw it on my own, but I do know that when it came on whatever cable TV we had at the time, which might have been on TV, it might have been select TV, we had, you know, all these different like boxes that sat up on the counter next to the television in the living room, and it came on and we recorded it on the family Betamax, and we had a Betamax recording of that we watched over and over and over again, and my dad and I both loved that movie.
Yeah, that was a movie you could really bond with your parents with. I think Jeff, your dad must have loved it.
Oh yeah, he was a huge Airplane fan.
Yeah, mine was too, and it was so good because you had a level of jokes that the kids got, and then a level of jokes that the adults got, and it was always that question from the kids to the adults: what does that mean? Shut up, keep watching.
Well, there's also a lot of references. You know, I mean, I don't know if anybody was aware at the time, but, you know, the film, the entire narrative structure of the film is based on a whole other movie. And it is basically beat for beat this B movie from, you know, 25, 30 years earlier called Zero Hour.
Yes. 1958.
Very good.
Yeah.
So you know, the fact that you could have this richer experience of it if you got all of the cinematic references to From Here to Eternity, or, you know, the sort of the more pop culture ones being like Jaws or Saturday Night Fever, you know. But there's that, like, there's that scene where the soldier is getting on the plane and saying goodbye to his sweetheart. Well, that's straight out of a David O. Selznick movie called Since You Went Away, where he throws the watch to his beloved as the plane is taxiing for takeoff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that, so there are so many layers to that movie, and it's interesting. It's very similar in a lot of ways to me to another spoof film that, you know, remains beloved and a classic, and one that my dad loved as well, Blazing Saddles. Blazing Saddles had all of these references to, you know, great old Westerns that if you watch today, I don't know who would get those references.
In 24 hours. That's all I ask.
No!
You do it for Randolph Scott.
Randolph Scott.
It's a richer experience if you get them, but it's still funny even if you don't. I always use this as an example. My first comedy album that I ever stole from my parents was this sort of sampler platter called The Comedians, and it had 7 or 8 cuts from Rodney Dangerfield and Jonathan Winters and Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks and Joan Rivers and Lenny Bruce. And the Lenny Bruce cut was Father Flotsky's Triumph, which was like a spoof of a prison movie, you know, with all of these character actors, you know, that whose names would probably mean nothing to any of you. But, you know, again, a richer experience if you get the references. Well, there are also jokes that are still super funny to this day. But when I was like 6 or 7 years old and I stole this album from my parents, I didn't get any of it, but I just knew it was funny because Lenny was so funny. There was a joke in there. So again, it's like a prison break movie, and you know, the prisoner is got a gun and he's barricaded himself inside the prison, and they're calling into him. Says, like, "All right, Dutch, we'll meet all of your demands, except for the vibrators." I was 6 or 7 years old. I have no idea what I could have thought that meant. But I knew it was funny. So, I think that it's really, really interesting when there is sort of reference-reliant comedy that people think, oh, this won't play because people won't get it. So, I don't know. I think funny sometimes just, you know, rises above it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy. There, a big thing on YouTube now is reaction videos, a whole generation that's reacting to older movies. And watching a lot of them watch Airplane, it's interesting the jokes that they get, the jokes that they don't get. They don't get the fact that it's Mrs. Cleaver saying the jive, and so,
but she's a sweet gray-haired old lady,
right?
So yes,
it still works.
You don't get the additional layer, the benefit of, oh my god, Barbara Billingsley is June Cleaver.
Yeah,
dummies, I duck a rap.
Got me some slack, Jack. Chump don't want to help. Chump don't get to help.
Say can't hang, say 7 up.
Jive ass dude don't got no brains in here.
Right,
but yeah, it's interesting how that works now.
The simple things that are in the background as you're watching the movie, the airplane announcements at LAX,
I grew up in LA. Those were the actual, so the man and woman who are making those announcements in the movie, those are the actual, that's the man and woman who did those announcements for real at LAX.
The red zone has always been for loading and unloading. There's never stopping in a white zone.
Don't tell me which zone is for stopping and which zone is for loading.
Listen, buddy, don't start up with your white zone.
When I was a little kid, I didn't know what they were arguing about, or, you know, as it just got progressed, but I just thought it was funny. Go ahead, Lizzie, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, watching it as an adult, one of the funny things to me was their relationship, Elaine and, was it Tim?
Ted.
Ted. Yeah, Elaine and Ted, how much disrespect she had for him and how much little faith she had in him was hilarious to me watching that as an adult. Because, like, I don't know if you guys have noticed, she's like, he can't possibly fly this plane, like, right in front of him.
They're both perfectly cast. I mean, that is one of the real triumphs of that movie. And I think one of the reasons it really does endure is the style of acting, the sincerity, the straight-faced, absolute commitment to the reality of the situation, despite the ridiculousness, is so good across the board. There is such a tonal consistency with all of these actors, and they're just some of the finest comedy performances ever, in my estimation.
They were told to treat it as a drama, correct? Yeah. To treat it real as and not crack up when someone says
absolutely
something.
Absolutely. And I think that some this is now I've done a very I'm getting ready to go on this tour now with David Zucker and Robert Hayes. So the film, for anyone watching or listening to this who doesn't know Airplane, who's still for some reason listening to this conversation, so Airplane was made in 1980 by three writer directors. By the way, a film had never been co-directed by three directors before, which is a whole story that's absolutely fascinating. But these three men who were worked together for years as the Kentucky Fried Theater. They moved from the Midwest to Los Angeles. They had a little theater on, I think it was on Pico Boulevard. They made a sketch movie called the Kentucky Fried Movie that they wrote, they appeared in. It was directed by John Landis. And then they wrote this screenplay for Airplane based on Zero Hour. Their names are Jerry Zucker, his brother David Zucker, and the late Jim Abrams, who just passed away, sadly. Mm-hmm. And so they wrote and directed this movie together, the trio of them. Their vision for this was that this was a kind of comedy that needed to be played absolutely straight, hence the casting of actors who were not known for comedy, like Peter Graves, like Robert Stack, like Leslie Nielsen. I mean, people now, they recontextualize Leslie Nielsen. Leslie Nielsen was a very well-respected straight actor. This was really his first time doing comedy. And then, of course, he continued to do comedies for them and for other people. According to them, now I've read this book that they wrote about the making of Airplane called Surely You Can't Be Serious. Terrific book. It's their oral history and
good audiobook too.
I read it as well.
Yeah, really funny and enlightening. And they said Robert Stack got it right away. Lloyd Bridges, it took a little while.
It's hard to believe that it took him a little while to be funny.
Yeah.
Well, and the interesting thing is his performance is not quite as calibrated. Like, he's actually, now I think it's perfect for the film, but he's actually kind of really going for it, where, you know, Stack is still kind of, he's in the pocket, you know, he's still kind of Elliot Ness.
Bridges just sort of unravels throughout the movie.
Yes. Yep. And he but it also works because, you know, he has that runner of looks like I picked the wrong week to quit drinking.
Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit drinking. Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit amphetamines. Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit sniffing glue.
So the escalation of that, you know, can, you know, help excuse the fact that his performance gets a little big.
I'll shut up, Jeff, after this. I'll shut up after this. I'm sorry. But I have to say that to the point of not understanding certain things in the movie when you're of a certain age, isn't it Robert Stack's wife who's in the film, who's in bed with the horse?
Peter Graves' wife, Captain Over's wife, who is in bed with the horse.
Yes. I didn't understand the context of that as a kid, but I laughed because it was just so absurd.
But you do understand it now.
Of course, yeah.
Much so. And you fully embrace it.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Jeff, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I was lucky enough to see a screening of Airplane with David Zucker on the Impractical Jokers cruise.
Oh, wow. How was that?
It was great, but it was not this director's cut, so I'm curious what's new in the director's cut that they're going to be taking around.
Well, here's my... Now, I have not done my first date yet with David, so I'll probably be able to explain this better when I get it, you know, articulated by him on stage as we, you know, do these next dates on this tour. I believe the tour, by the way, starts on October 3rd in Seattle and then picks up again in November when we're doing Denver, Colorado. And we're doing three dates in Texas right after the Denver date in, the, I think, the first week of November. And I think there'll be more dates after that. But here's my take on why there's a director's cut. Most artists I know, particularly filmmakers, are never completely satisfied with their work, even if it is, you know, some of the best regarded work in the field. And I think that's evidenced by the fact that the Coen brothers went back and recut their film Blood Simple, which, I mean, one of the great, you know, directorial debuts, I think, ever. And of course, George Lucas did his special edition of Star Wars, which sent, you know, multiple generations of nerds, you know, screaming with their hair on fire. But I really do believe that every artist I know, and I've known many, look at their work and all they can see is what they would have done differently. So, you know, listen, God bless him. He's David Zucker. If he wants to potchkey with it and then, you know, show it to an audience and see if it works and explain why he wants to change this and tweak that, as long as we get all the great stories, I'm all in.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I hope it comes to Atlanta so we can all go.
Yeah.
I will speak to the man.
I will nerd out on that for sure.
Yeah, I was looking at the dates.
I just I want to see David Letterman's audition tape is what I want to see.
Yeah.
Isn't that
out there?
I've seen a little bit of it when they I think Zucker and Abrams went on Letterman and showed a little bit of
a clip.
They did. In fact, if you can find the video of that appearance when they were on Letterman, I think it's like 82. And so it's the three of them that come on together. And every time they cut to a commercial and come back, they have one pair of glasses and a blazer. And they cut to a commercial and someone else is wearing the glasses and the blazer. And they cut to a commercial and someone else is wearing the glasses and the blazer. And they come back and they show David Letterman's audition for Airplane. And then David Letterman is wearing the glasses and the blazer.
We were all talking about our favorite lines and scenes from Airplane. Do you have a favorite line or a favorite scene?
Do I? Oh, God. I mean, I'm really partial to Steven Stucker. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Yeah, he's awesome.
Johnny, what can you make out of this?
This? Well, I can make a cap or a brooch or a pterodactyl.
When he pulls the plug and the lights go out. Just kidding.
Oh, my God. Everything he does, because he's in a whole other movie. Steven Stucker is in his own movie. And I just sort of feel like you're just seeing like electric comic energy. Like, so I remember after seeing the movie, there's a line, it makes no sense, where they say the storm is getting thicker and he jumps out and he grabs this man by the midsection. He goes, and Leon is getting larger. And then he jumps out.
The fog is getting thicker.
And Leon's getting larger.
And it's just surrealistic and it's weird. And that's my sense of humor. And I used to do that to my dad. So after the movie came out, I would go, and Leon's getting larger. My dad would hate me when I would do that.
It's one of the few things that my mother and I were able to bond over were movies and comedians and television shows. And she loved Airplane. And she really loved Robert Hays. So she watched Angie. And so I had to watch Angie. But not that I'm complaining, but I didn't really understand that dynamic so much. But it's how I was able
Angie,
to watch.
Angie, which starred Tim?
Donna Pascal.
Donna Pascal,
Donna
yeah.
Pascal was Angie, and her mother was played by?
Ray's mom.
Everybody Loves Raymond.
That's right. Doris Roberts. All right. Yeah. You guys are doing well.
We can't keep up, but we're trying.
You're doing very, very well.
Yeah, speaking of those records, how did you get started collecting the autographed comedy albums?
Well, so I started, like I say, stealing comedy albums from my parents. So like that album that I cited before, the Comedians, I loved all of these cuts and I listened to them over and over and over again. And then I would get a little bit of allowance money, or I would do something where I could make a little bit of money as a kid. And then I would ride my bike, usually to Rhino Records, the original Rhino Records on Westwood Boulevard. And in the used bins, you could find whole albums by Rodney or Jonathan Winters or Joan Rivers or any of these people. So then I started amassing a pretty good sized record collection. Well, one of the things, remember I talked about how great it was that I grew up in LA because I got the Dr. Demento show live on KMET. Well, guess what? The other thing about growing up in LA is if you like all of these people, you're probably going to run into them. In fact, I was going to school for 4th, 5th, and 6th grade with Carol Burnett's daughters, Bob Newhart's kids. Mindy Rickles was, I think, 2 years ahead of me. I think Larry was the year behind her. Larry Rickles, Don Rickles' kids.
Yeah.
I think they were the same year. Larry was the same year, I believe, as Melissa Rosenberg, later Melissa Rivers, Jones' daughter. So I knew all of these people. So you could get them to sign stuff, but you would also see, Mel Brooks at Factor's Delicatessen. So you could get stuff signed. And I would go to the live Dr. Demento remote broadcasts. You know, he did a remote on KMET from the tower on Sunset, the Sunset Strip. So I would take my copy of Dr. Demento's Delights and Dr. Demento's Dementia Royale, and he signed those for me there. Well, you know, I have OCD, so once you start collecting something, now you have to have all of it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, go try and get every comedy album ever made signed. Well,
how many are you at right now?
I have several thousand comedy albums. I think I have about 500 signed.
So you don't move a lot.
I haven't moved since we left Atlanta. We left Atlanta and came up here, and we live in the Northeast now. So we tend not to move a lot. But
what do you think the most valuable one you have might be?
So there's some that have been purchased. So because the artists were passed away, my mom for my 40th birthday bought me a signed copy of An Evening with Groucho.
Wow!
So. But I do have a copy of Monty Python Live at City Center signed by all 6 of the Pythons, including the 2 dead ones, and Neil Innes, who's also dead. So I have that. I love having the albums that have multiple artists that are signed by all of the artists. So I have Cheech and Chong. I have Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner. I have Mike Nichols and Elaine May on one of their albums. I have multiple albums signed by all 4 members of the Fire Sign Theater, 2 of whom are no longer with us.
Right. Stan Freberg.
I have a great copy of Stan Freberg Presents the United States of America, Volume 1. And he signed the inscription on that album is to my friend Dan, who knows my work better than I do. By the way, I have a great story about when I had that album signed. So I was having lunch with Stan at this restaurant in Brentwood called Toscana. I went into the restaurant. I got there first. I got the table. And sitting alone, as he often would be at that very restaurant, was George Carlin, another one of my heroes, and someone that when I was in my early stand-up years, I got to open for. So I knew him a little bit, you know, enough that if I went over and said, "Hey, George, Dan Pastrnak," "Oh, hey, man, how are you?" You know, and I said to him, "I'm having lunch today with another one of my comedy heroes, Stan Freberg." And George got really excited. Now, George used to collect autographs, too. Lest you think, you know, that, you know, only uncool people stalk their comedy heroes for autographs. Cool guys like George Carlin do, too. So he was like, "Oh, wow, man, can I come over and say hi?" I was like, "Yeah." So Stan comes to the table and he sits down, and George Carlin. Now, keep in mind, I'm at a table sitting with Stan Freberg, and George Carlin comes over and begins to do the Peter Leeds part of the Banana Boat record. He goes, "Hey, man, it's too loud, man. It's too piercing." And I'm losing my fucking mind. I just think this is comedy nirvana. I'm watching George Carlin do Stan Freberg to Stan Freberg.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's
awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know Carlin was into that, but it explains why he was so nice. Jeff had an internship at HBO, so he knew Carlin's schedule, and Carlin was going to Elmira, New York, so Jeff told us where he was going to be, what time his plane land, and we shared the same girlfriend, not at the same time, but our girlfriend at the time, she went to the airport because I had to work, and Carlin got off the plane and she was waiting there for him, and she pulls out my LP of Class Clown. So that's my most cherished autographed record, and I don't have
that's
a lot
great.
DD covers. I have a ton of, because being on the regular guys, we had comics come in every week, or we would go see them. And I'd buy all their discs and get their autographs. But that Carlin one's very special to me, you know. And I have his books because I went and met him at book signings. But to get that was really cool.
And well, I love every time I would see him, I would bring a couple albums and have him sign. And because he was an autograph collector, he was cool with it. So one evening, my friend Paul Provenza and I were at my house in Manhattan Beach, and we found out Carlin was going to be at the Comedy and Magic Club in Hermosa. I think this is like 2005 or six. So, you know, pretty much the last couple of years of George's life. But we heard he was going to Comedy Magic because he's working on the new HBO Hour. And Provenza and I, at that time, we were writing a pilot for Showtime, but we were like, "Oh, we're going to take the night off. We're going to go see George." So I think Paul and our friend Rick Overton and I, the three of us, went to see Carlin. Now, by the way, there is a DVD box set of Carlin's with some bonus discs. And one of the bonus discs is the recording of that exact performance at the Comedy and Magic Club. And you can hear my very distinctive laugh throughout this performance.
That's great. So
afterwards, we go into the green room at Comedy Magic, and we're like, you know, talking about the set, and we're pitching tags for jokes. And we're like comics, just like a bunch of comics, like, you know, doing what you do after the gig. And he was like, "Hey, I'm doing the Tonight Show in a couple of days. You guys want to come and hang out?" It's like, "Yeah, I think we do. Yes, thank you. Yes, thank you." And I believe this turned out to be George's last appearance on The Tonight Show. So we go, and I bring a couple albums to have him sign. We go, he does stand up, does a great set, sit down, does panel. Then the next guest comes. The next guest is Ann Coulter.
Did you get that?
So Ann Coulter comes. Now I think, oh my God, George is going to have a field day. He has one great line. He says, "I can't believe," because he moves down the panel. He says, "I can't believe Ann Coulter made me move to the right." Great line, right?
Classic line.
Yeah. Great line. But then lets her do her thing. Fine, whatever. Afterwards, I've got my albums, and I'm hanging out with George, and he's signing the albums. And this guy comes over and starts talking to me. He goes, "What do you got there?" I don't know. It was a copy of like Toledo Window Box, and I can't remember one of the other albums. This guy's seeing, you know, George sign the albums, and we're just talking. I don't know who this guy is. He says to me, do you have any Orson Bean comedy albums? I said, yeah, I have Orson Bean at the Hungry Eye. He says, do you have it signed? It's like, no. He says, I can get that signed for you. So the guy gives me his contact info. So I put him in my phone. I put his name. I put his phone number. I put his email. And I put Orson Bean in the subject line. For whatever reason, I didn't follow it up. Fast forward many years. George has since passed away. And Orson Bean dies. And I'm really, really, really bummed out. And I'm reading, because I never followed it up. And I'm reading his obituary. And it says that Orson Bean's daughter had been married to Andrew Breitbart.
Yep.
Yep.
I look in my phone and I realize Ann Coulter's friend and guest who was there, who just came over to see what George Carlin was signing for me, was Andrew Breitbart. Andrew Breitbart was in my phone. I had no idea that that's who I was talking to.
Wow. Well, Lizzie, you had some questions, too. I feel like I keep dominating. Every time we have guests, Dan, I always say, everybody, I'm gonna get out of your way. And then I just start babbling too much. So I'm going to.
No, I mean, I've loved listening to him talk. It's, well, we were talking about, like, if Airplane would go over with today's kids, right? Like, I watched it when I was 6. Tim, you mm-hmm. watched it when you were 10.
Yeah.
You were 11. So I did a little homeschool experiment today because I homeschool my kid. He's 8. And okay. We watched Airplane. And I had him write what he thought about it after he watched it. And he eats that stuff up. Like, he loves film and comedy. And
do you have what he wrote with you?
It's upstairs, but I do remember it. So
okay.
Yeah, I do.
Lizzie, why didn't you bring what he wrote? I was like, this is his big buildup.
I was in a rush to
go. And here's what my 8-year-old son wrote about Airplane.
He had no idea it was a comedy, which was great because he starts watching it and he thinks it's an action movie because he hears the music in the background and he's not listening. Like, he hears the people talking. And
well, that's the other thing, by the way, the music is a whole other conversation because the music also is very much like the acting. So Elmer Bernstein did that score. Now, Elmer Bernstein had done, like, mostly dramatic films, I think, until John Landis hired him to do Animal House. And then he started doing a lot of comedy films because people found, like an Animal House, like an Airplane, that these very straight, sincere orchestral scores actually really work very well for a certain kind of comedy. I forget who posited the question. So could you do it today? Would it play today? I think you've answered the question.
Yeah.
I think it would.
Yeah. I have a 19-year-old as well, and she was home, and I tried to get her in to watch some of it too so I could get her reaction. But and I'm shocked she was like, I've never seen that movie, which shocks me because I'm her mom. I think she has and she just doesn't remember is what I'm assuming.
You know, so there's a theater not too far from where I live that occasionally shows like new prints of classic films. And occasionally I would take my kid. Now my kid's now off at college, but a couple of years ago, there were these restored prints of some old Laurel and Hardy shorts. So we're talking really old. And I just said to my daughter, yeah, come with me. And so, okay. Comes with me. She's laughing harder than anybody in the theater and said to me afterwards, Dada, that was so much funnier than I thought it was going to be.
Nice.
Yeah,
that's great.
And I love you talking about, you know, going to see Laurel and Hardy. I asked Frank Santopadre when we interviewed him. I said, what age is a good age to start watching the Three Stooges with your child? Because my son is 4. Mm-hmm. And started watching an episode, and then I saw in his eyes, he had a brightness in his eyes. He was, first of all, it's black and white. He's never really seen anything black and white, so he's looking at it, and he's following it. And I start worrying, okay, I don't want him going to school and punching kids and poking them in the eyes, so we're going to wait on this. But he likes the music. There's this record. Now it's just Moe and Larry, and I forget which fake stooge it is. Is it Curly? Is it Joe Derita?
You know, that would be Joe Derita was Curly Joe, or it was could have been Joe Besser.
It's the one with like three little fishies and on this song.
Yeah, that was Curly Joe. Yeah.
And those are great songs for kids, and he's fascinated by that, and he loves it. So that makes me happy. But I see that spark in his eyes. And again, he's only four, so I'm that's one of the things I'm looking forward to, introducing him slowly to things. My overall point is there's so much good stuff from the past that I want to introduce him to. So it's nice that, you know, what you've done and what Lizzie's doing is keeping these things alive. It's important.
Well, I mean, I do think that that's a sort of a part of what I'm doing with, you know, some of these live events that we're touring, like doing a tour for the 45th anniversary of Airplane, or, you know, a little later in the year, we're going to be doing the 40th anniversary of Stand By Me. And we've got Will Wheaton, Corey Feldman, and Jerry O'Connell, the first time the three of them have gotten together to do anything publicly since making the film.
Former Radio Labyrinth podcast guest.
Which one?
Corey Feldman.
Yeah. Oh, really? Okay, cool. Who's also now a contestant on Dancing with the Stars this season. Just didn't know whether you wanted me to talk about the the John Candy I Like Me tour.
God, I do want to hear about that, yeah.
Yes.
So that came about because Ryan Reynolds I've known for 25 years, and he came to speak to my class. I teach a class in TV development at NYU, at the Tisch School of the Arts. So he came to speak to my class, and he mentioned that he was doing this documentary. And he is passionate about loving John Candy. By the way, never met the man. He never worked with the man. But he just always loved John Candy. And so I said, this sounds incredible. Are you going to have a theatrical window for this? And he said, no, we're doing it for streaming. It's going to be on, Amazon Prime. He said, we'll premiere it at the Toronto International Film Festival, and then it'll go to Amazon. And I said, I mean, it sounds so magical and joyful, and people have this immediate emotional reaction when you talk about John Candy in a way that they don't have with a lot of other stars or comedians. And I said, I think this would be great to have a little tour where real audiences, not, you know, industry people, not festivals, but like real people can sit in a theater, have a communal experience of this film. And then you could tell them why 31 years now after John Candy's passing, it was so important to you to make this film. And he just said, yes, I want to do that. So we are in 2 weeks going to do a little tour. We're going to do a little jog around the Northeast. I'm going to moderate. There's another moderator named Kevin McCarthy who's going to do, there's going to be a date in LA, one in Chicago, and one in Toronto. So we're going to do a handful of dates before it comes to Amazon. So, and that's starting in 2 weeks. And tickets are on sale now if you go to johncandy.com.
And not Kevin McCarthy from Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
No.
Not Kevin McCarthy from Invasion of the Body Snatchers. May he rest in peace.
Yeah.
Gilbert always did a great job.
I think I saw the trailer for that.
Yeah, it made me.
Yeah, it looks great.
Yeah, it's really good.
It made me emotional.
I've seen it.
Sure.
It's terrific. And it's as intimate. I mean, I really thought, oh, this is going to be an overview of his career. But because Ryan got, John Candy's widow and his two children, and then everyone you can think of that worked with him at Second City TV, got Steve Martin, got Dan Aykroyd,
Bill Murray,
Macaulay Culkin, like everyone you can think of to, you know, share their memories and, you know, thoughts about John Candy. It's great.
The whole world that we're supposed to pay attention to doesn't exist to me anymore. It's about things that we love and celebrate, and having you on and talking about a movie that we love, and we're fans of yours. You were great on that two episodes with Robert Spiegel. And are you going to be back on? I hope so. Because I didn't know.
Yeah, I just recorded another one with Frank and my friend Mark Malkoff, who's just written a book about Johnny Carson, and Mike Reese, who was one of the showrunners on The Simpsons and who also wrote for Johnny Carson. So Johnny Carson's 100th birthday is coming up next month. Oh. So we did a whole episode about Johnny Carson.
Oh, now, nice. Cool. Can't wait for that.
Is this book going to be favorable to Carson? Because the one his lawyer wrote certainly wasn't.
I didn't even read that garbage. Like, yeah. I'm so not interested in that. No, this is, look, if you love Johnny Carson, this book by Mark Malkoff is called literally Love Johnny Carson. Nice. And it is just as deep a dive as you want to take into what made him great, what made that show extraordinary. And so Mark and I have also been working on this project for latenighter.com, and it'll be coming out around the same time as the book and probably this episode of Fun for All Ages called The Carson 100. And it's literally in chronological order, like 100 just classic moments from The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. So, you know, whether you were alive for them or not, there's moments that, you know, maybe got revisited in an anniversary special or you've just heard about, or, you know, you saw at one point in, you know, in your feed, if you have an algorithm like mine, but everything that you can imagine that would be on that list is on that list, the Carson 100.
Well, I'm going to be that. So thank you for letting me know. And I will be bookmarking and watching all of that because Carson's in all my feeds. It's great, and I miss those days. Even though I like being an adult and having a son, I do miss those days of just you know, staying up until, I don't know, 1 o'clock in the morning in the summer. You know, growing up watching
that was that. I mean, again, that's how I bonded with my dad. You know, I was, you know, an insomniac, and I would never go to bed when I was supposed to go to bed, and I would come out, and my dad would say, "Okay, you can watch the monologue," and then I would say, "All right, maybe he's going to do Karnak." And so, all right, we'll see if he's going to do a Karnak. All right, we'll see who the first guest is. All right, maybe, you know, oh, there's a comic. You want to see the comic? And then it was 1 a.m. So they.
If I was good at Saturday evening church, we were raised Catholic. So if I was good, if me and my sister didn't fight in the aisles, like I could stay up to watch Saturday Night Live with my dad.
Who was your cast?
That was my treat.
Who was your cast, Lizzie, on SNL?
Probably Chris Farley, David Spade. But I would watch. So we moved to Georgia when I was 8. And for some reason in New Jersey, we didn't have Comedy Central. So when I moved to Georgia, they had Comedy Central. But all they played on Comedy Central was like 2 Drink Minimum and old episodes of Saturday Night Live, SCTV, and what's it called? 3000, the movie.
Oh, Mystery Science Theater 3000.
And I watched it all. But so I started watching the old episodes. And like I would watch Gilda Radner run into walls in her bedroom. And then I would take it to school. And like
the Judy Show. Kids
had her run into walls. But I was like, "Dad, can I please watch the new episodes of Saturday Night Live? Like, Mom and Dad, can I please? And they were like, "Well, it comes on too late." Okay, if you behave at church, you can start watching the new episodes. And so, yeah, I've seen them all. So that was the cast I started with, like in my time.
The first time I ever watched it was my mom let me stay up because she wanted to watch it. Steve Martin was the host. So it must have been 76, I think. That's the first one I remember watching. Of course, I've seen them all. So when you ask us who our casts are, we go all the way up till, I don't know, now, I guess. But yeah, the first cast I really got into were the Ebersol years. Because when it was the Gene Dumanian season, I was watching Fridays. Because I thought that show was
interesting. They weren't competing with each other. The one was on Friday, one was on Saturday.
I know. But my dad had an antenna. So when I go to my dad's house, the antenna, if you wanted to watch NBC, you had to go out and fiddle with the antenna. And Saturday nights were ABC nights because it was Love Boat and Fantasy Island. So that's, but back at home, we had cable. But I loved Fridays and I still annoy people with if I see clips of it or whatever, I'll watch them because that was a
good show. Here's your last quiz then, Tim Andrews. How many members of the cast of Fridays 10 you name.
Melanie Chardoff, Larry David, Michael Richards. Oh, God. And then you get into, oh, I can see all their faces. I just don't remember all their names. Give me one more second. I'll think. I'd have to cheat, and I don't want to cheat. So those
Bruce
three.
Bruce Mahler.
Bruce Mahler, yes, who was in that weird 80s movie where he played like a crazy doctor, right?
No, that's Mark Blankfield.
Yeah. Mark Blankfield, okay.
Bruce Mahler was in the Police Academy film.
Yeah. That's right. That's yeah. right. That's right. Okay.
Mary Edith Burrell.
Yes, very funny.
Daryl Igus.
Who was Daryl Igus? Was he the impersonator?
He was the African-American cast member. There was only one. No, the one who did the impressions was John Rourke.
Yes, and he played Bush I'm losing it now. Naked Gun 2, he played Bush, right?
Oh, did he? Yeah, I don't know that I remembered that.
I think that was him because he did all the impressions.
But I think we got everybody, right? You said Melanie Chardoff.
Yeah, well, I was in love with her. She's one of the first celebrities I ever was like, oh, she's so pretty. That was
very pretty. She's still very pretty.
Oh, I know.
And then went on to be the principal on Parker Lewis Can't Lose.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember that show.
No, I feel bad because I don't remember their names.
Kevin Nealon was the host of the news when I started watching SNL live.
Oh, okay.
So he would crack me up because he would do this thing where like his head would be spinning and the globe would be spinning. Yeah. But then you would just see him and it would be his chair.
Yeah. Oh.
He was in between Dennis Miller and Norm, right?
Yeah. I believe so.
Well, Norm wasn't right after him.
Norm was right after him. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Norm was right after him. And he tells one of my favorite jokes ever on the show, which is, number two on or number one on the charts this week is better than Ezra. Number two, Ezra.
That is a classic Norm update joke. Absolutely. My favorite Norm update joke was during the OJ trial. Of course, all the OJ jokes were my favorites. And in fact, when we made the deal with him at Super Deluxe to do a CGI news desk show, prerequisite and the understanding was that he was going to be doing OJ jokes because, of course, he was discouraged from doing OJ jokes and, you know, supposedly may have been fired for doing OJ on update. So, but my favorite OJ joke was that Johnny Cochran put on OJ's knit cap before the jury during the trial, to which OJ could be heard yelling from his seat, "Hey, be careful with that. That's my lucky stabbing cap."
Dan, I think we probably kept you probably way too long.
Where people can get tickets for these tours and let people know where they can find you online.
So you can find me at obsessivecomedydisorder.net. I'm also on Blue Sky. You can find tickets for the John Candy I Like Me An Evening with Ryan Reynolds and Friends at johncandy.com. I would say just search for where you can find the airplane tour or the Stand By Me tour. I don't have those URLs handy. There is standbymelive.com. How about that? Standbymelive.com. I don't have the airplane one here. Darn it. All right.
I'll put them in the description. So.
Awesome. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. It was really fun.
Yeah,
likewise.
Hey, I'm back, Mr. Sam Elliott, and I want to talk to you about one of the places I like to go whenever I'm in the Atlanta area, called Atlanta Pizza and Gyro. And they've proudly been serving the East Metro Atlanta area for over 40 years. Atlanta Pizza and Gyro is a place to be this summer. I don't know if they have Coors. Coors is a banquet beer. But they are featuring Three Tavern Breweries and Night on Ponce. That's an IPA, and it's now available on draft. Atlanta Pizza Nero has the best gyros, pizzas, hot subs, and Greek and Italian specialties around. Family-owned and operated, independent restaurants are a dying breed. And Atlanta Pizza Nero continues to be a local favorite, serving the east side of Atlanta for over 30 years. Hey, Mike's food truck is out and about, so if you see the food truck, run up. Contact Mike at 770-483-6228 if you're interested in booking the food truck for your corporate or private event. Tuesday nights, they got team trivia from 7 to 8:30 p.m. Bring your smartest friends and test your trivia knowledge against the best Conyers has to offer. Hey, they're open for dine-in or takeout Monday through Friday from 11 to 9. Saturdays, 12 to 9. They're closed on Sunday, which is Lord's Day, dude. Another fine sponsor of Radio Labyrinth is LDI Repro Printing. Do you have commercial or residential construction printing needs? Well, what are you waiting for? Contact LDI Repro Printing of Athens. They've been in Athens, Georgia since 2005. With fast turnaround and affordable prices, call 706-316-9366 or email them at athens@ldiline.com.
Radio Labyrinth is brought to you this week and every week by our wonderful sponsors, the Punchline Comedy Club in Atlanta, Georgia. Coming up at the Punchline, September 18th through the 20th, comedian Ben Bankus, who's from Canada originally and now lives in Austin, Texas. On the 21st, it is Brad Upton. The 26th through the 28th is Eddie Ift, who is a very funny comedian. And coming October 2nd through the 4th, comedian Shane Smith. Go to punchline.com for all the details and to get tickets. And starting next week, be looking for your opportunity on Patreon. You have to be a Patreon member to win a pair of tickets to an upcoming show. All right, you guys ready to do some plugs? Yes, let's do some plugs, Tim, please. Trambles is on hiatus for a little bit because now I am working on the follow-up book to Selfies. The name of this book is Fabricants. It's book two in the Manifold series, and I just started it, and it's going to take me a lot of time. If I can get around to it, I will do some more episodes if you people like it. And by you people, I mean everybody, not, you know, I know Lizzie likes me.
I do. That bums me out.
I'll do me's just for Lizzie.
Thank you.
I still do the podcast, which is, even though it's Georgia football season, you can still catch it after Georgia football on Saturdays on WSB. It's called The Popcast. And this week's episode, which comes out, I guess if you're getting this episode on, you know, the Saturday it comes out, it's tonight. So you can listen to it on the WSB radio app or wait for the podcast. My guests this week are returning Jeff Plate, who is a founding member and the drummer for Trans-Siberian Orchestra, who are going on tour again this Christmas and will be in Atlanta area, I think on December 14th, because I'm going to go in Duluth. And what the cool thing about Jeff is I like talking to him. I always get offered a chance to speak to members of the band. I always choose Jeff because he lives in Horseheads, New York, and he's a Buffalo Bills fan.
That's going to be this Saturday?
Saturday night. And not only that, on this episode, comedian Ben Bankus will be on the show. We tried to get him on this, but we weren't able to work it out. But I did interview him on for the podcast, so that'll also be available to you.
And tonight we're all going to Greg Warren.
Yeah, if you want to come hang out with us, come to the 6 o'clock show tonight at the Punchline. And that, of course, would be Saturday the
13th.
13th, thank you very much. Let's see. Yeah, and Greg was busy. He was opening for Leanne, so I understand why he couldn't do our show. Hey, would you like to become a member of the Patreon page? Well, just go to patreon.com/Tim Andrews and sign up. You have the opportunity to ask questions when you're a Patreon member. If we have a guest, we'll give you a heads up. You can also become a producer at the $25 level, which will get you a t-shirt from our t-shirt shop, and you'll get a credit each and every week because you produce the show and help us continue doing it. I want to thank The Walkman. I like that name. I'm going to keep calling him that. John Allen, Matt Carter, Chris Chandler, Mike D, Jim Fortner, Roby Neely, Jeff Peterson, Tim Slayton, and Brian and Chelsea Smith. Remember to rate and review and love us on Spotify or wherever you listen to the show. And if you're just a listener, please go to YouTube, sign in,
and subscribe to the YouTube channel, because Dustin busts his ass and makes that show look really, really good each and every week. So unless there's anything else, please remember to keep it canon.
They say all good things come to an end.
What's that got to do with this show?
Lost in the radio.